Audie.
An on location episode of the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesconand. I'm in Casa Tony, a busy and traditional tapas bar in central Madrid, with James Blick from Devour Tours and the Spain Revealed YouTube channel, talking Spanish food, culture, history, beer, lamb neck glands, New Zealanders drinking in Shepherd's Bush, Russian roulette with padron peppers, Jesus nailed to the cross, General Franco, Civil War, flamenco, 4 meter pianos, Farrah Fawcett hair, Barcelona, Cadiz, gentrification, and is Spanish coffee good or bad? What don't we talk about? I don't know, but it's a brilliant conversation and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Welcome James Blick to the Big Travel Podcast. It's funny what you were saying about Madrid being, landlocked and, and it's quite difficult to get the food in here. I remember reading this beautiful extract from Laurie Lee about the fish trains. Because they'd have trains that used to come in every morning loaded with fish and seafood, fresh from the seaside.
Yeah.
Well, there's this beautiful evocative description about that.
And it's interesting because Madrid has, after the fish market in Tokyo, it's the second largest fish market in the world. You can't visit it. It's like it's there for the fishmongers to go to in the mornings. But you know, our local street food or sandwich is the bocadillo de calamares, which is like a calamari sandwich. So why the hell, you know, do we have calamari sandwich as like the thing you eat when you're growing up and you go to the Plaza Mayor with your parents? You eat that, and why is that? Well, I mean, it's the capital in a Catholic country, and not so much these days, but back in the day, there were just a lot of dishes. Gracias. There were a lot of days you couldn't eat meat, right? Fridays, certain saints feasts and things like that. So the fish was just such a critical part of the diet here, you know, and that was a big part of it, was the religious element. So back when it was Laurie Lee, they're shipping it, and still having, now it's on trucks. I don't know if it's on train, to be honest, but I suspect they're not dumping fish on the Ave. There is no Ave because most of it comes from the north, so it will just be trucked in every day.
It was just a beautiful trucks. Description, and reading Laurie Lee again made me really want to do some more exploration of Spain, because I grew up here in Malaga on the south coast.
Yeah, that's right, you said that.
From the age of 7 to 16, and then at 16 I was off, and I went to England, and my parents still lived here, so I'd come back and visit my parents, but I limited my travelling, I travelled around the world, but when I came here, a bit like when you don't really explore your home country as much, do you? And, you know, especially Spain, you know, I'd just come back and see my family, so I explored quite a little bit as I got older, and then sort of went abroad. Yeah. So I'm really determined to now come back and start really exploring Spain.
And I think that's great. You know, people come to Madrid, to Barcelona, you know, there's hot spots, of course, every country has them. Seville, you know, what I want to do more and more, and I can't so much do it through Devour Tours, because to operate we have to be in a large city to offer tours. But, you know, particularly through the YouTube channel, is more and more travel outside Madrid, go to places that help promote those areas. Yeah, I mean, even Galicia, people don't go to Galicia. More and more people are going up there, but the food is incredible.
And it's meant to be so wonderful and green. I haven't been to Galicia.
It looks like New Zealand up there. It's not the image people have of Spain.
Which is where you're from, so I think that seems a good sort of intro. Actually, let's have some beer, because we don't want to...
Cheers.
We don't want to leave the beer, especially these are beautiful glasses.
Exactly.
So yeah, it seems that let's have a bit of beer.
Yeah. Dutch courage.
Oh, that's really good.
Yeah.
And what I love about Spanish beer is it's served in small glasses.
Yeah.
And it doesn't get warm. I think that's the whole point of it. It's like I can't manage a pint in England.
No.
I can drink several beers, but I like a nice little small glass.
Exactly. I mean, I think, you know, these are slightly larger because we're upstairs in the dining room, but as you see the smaller ones downstairs, they serve the caña glass. And yeah, it is that. It's the warmth, but it's not all about the warmth. I think it also reflects the fact that, you know, I feel like when I go to a pub in England, everything gets quieter and insular. It's the carpet, the fire's crackling, everything gets so kind of withdrawn a little bit. You walk into a Spanish bar and everything expands. You expand, and there's noise, there's everything. And so you go and you have a few beers and then you keep going. But if you have to sit on a beer, it slows the experience down. But if there's smaller beers, it's like a punctuation mark. Like, do we get another round of cañas here or do we go next door? And it sort of creates that energy. It's like the rhythm is faster.
But yet, Spanish people don't
don't seem to get as smashed as British people, which is interesting.
Or New Zealanders.
Exactly. As a sort of
growing up, that was the goal. When I first moved here, I went to a party, and it was I'd been living here since 2011, and there was a South African guy at the party, and he was maybe 25 or something like that. I was about 32 at that point, and I'd gotten a little bit used to all the sort of Spanish way of going to parties. That they would party, and would go late, and they wouldn't drink a lot. My wife would still be going at sort of 4 a.m. and should have had like four beers or something like that. And we're at this party, and this South African guy was drinking heavily right from sort of 7 p.m. He was asleep by 10 o'clock. I saw that, and I was like, yes, that was the culture that I come from. Australia, South Africa, that whole kind of culture is like, yeah, you just get really hammered, you're asleep on the sofa by 11 p.m. and that's a success. But no, very much here, it just keeps on going. You don't rely on the alcohol as a lubricant for being social. That's what we need. We need that lubricant. But in Spain, people don't need it.
I've got the worst of both worlds in many ways. On the Costa del Sol, where I grew up in a very British sort of expat area, is that we'll go out early and start drinking early and still stay out until 5 or 6
in the morning. Created a new culture there.
It's the best of both worlds in many ways. But actually, in terms of like going out and drinking, it's a lot of fun. It's the worst of both worlds.
It takes its toll.
We try and pace ourselves more. But I love that about here in Spain. I love those late nights. I love that you can easily go dancing somewhere and see a band. And you can, to a certain extent, where we live in London. London's 24-hour city in many ways, but it's not the same. It's not as easy.
Easy thing. And I mean, I haven't lived in London, but I know, say, in New Zealand, there's a certain compactness of the cities where a lot of the people are going out, and there's an energy about it that you can go to multiple places. It's not as formal. You're not going to sit down for dinner necessarily, and so the fact is you can just walk into a place, you meet there, and invent the evening as you go, and then maybe you end up dancing or maybe you don't or whatever it is. And I like that idea that we don't make plans here in the same way. You'll plan when to meet. Nobody's quite sure what's going to happen after that. And I think in New Zealand it would be a little bit more like, well, I've got a reservation at this place, and then maybe we'll do this. And here, when I met my wife, and I would be more coming from that perspective of like, what's the plan? She'll be like, hey, chill out. Like, don't, I don't know. And I realize I've learned how to think like a Spaniard a little bit. And when you come with the questions that you would ask in your culture. You're like, well, why is that not open? Or what's the plan? What are we doing? And then you learn over time that it's actually pointless to ask those questions. And you stop asking, you start asking other questions. Who are we meeting for starters?
Hey, we've got some food. Wonderful. So we've got some. I should take a photo, really. The mushrooms look amazing.
Yeah.
So if you don't mind, I'm going to get you to explain what we've got here.
Okay.
I know exactly what we've got here, but for anyone who doesn't.
You ready? Okay, so what we have here, we're at Casa Tony in the middle of Madrid. We've got four different dishes. There's another one coming. We've got the famous pimientos de Padrón. These are green peppers from the north of Spain, and they're flash fried in olive oil, some salt scattered over the top, and that's it. Some of them are sometimes spicy. Generally more in August, you'll find spicier ones, but it's a little bit of Russian roulette. You never know what's going to be spicy. Patatas bravas, really simple tapa, but delicious. What I love about how they do them at Casa Tony is they're double fried, so they're pillowy on the inside, crispy on the outside, and they make their own brava sauce, which is great because a lot of places don't make their own brava sauce and just mix ketchup and Tabasco. You don't want that. Then we have, and it shows the simplicity of tapas. This is just some grilled mushrooms, some grilled wild mushrooms. They put them on the grill, bit of garlic, bit of salt, serve it with a slice of lemon. You squeeze it on, and that's all it is. So simple. And I think what I love about these tapas bars is that a lot of what we have in front of us is there's not a lot of cooking necessarily going in of combining ingredients. It's about taking great produce, doing something with it, throwing it on the grill, and that's that. Chopitos, baby cuttlefish. So these are battered. What I love how they do these, they're very tender. They're more tender than calamari, I find, is that they're beer battered, but literally that means that they open the tap of beer over the top of them and then dunk them in the flour and the batter and then just fry them, and that's all it is. And usually they'll serve these things with a little slice of lemon and you squeeze it over the top and you get stuck in. You'll notice we don't have any plates, individual plates. You don't want those because you're just going to use your fingers or fork in the middle. We share the food. It's almost like if we're eating at a Chinese restaurant, you're all reaching past each other, and that's part of the beauty of tapas, is you're reaching into other people's personal space, and that means you connect more. That's what I love about it.
I love it the way you clicked into your YouTube personality there. So tell us about the YouTube. Like, tell us. Well, let's eat as well. Yeah. No, it doesn't get hard. As this is the first time I've done this, I don't know how to sort of eat and talk. What do you do? Do you eat and talk?
Yeah. You know, just eat, talk, pick things up.
And, yeah.
Bit of lemon.
Yeah. Oh, I got a spicy one.
Oh, did you? Do you know what? I don't think I've ever got a spicy one.
It's very rare.
It's just so nice. It's just so simple, but so nice, isn't it?
Exactly. So how did I get to Spain? Growing up in New Zealand, you're always far away from everything. And my family had always traveled a lot, lived in Asia, so travel was kind of a part of our DNA. We lived in LA for a while when I was growing up. And I got to a point, you know, as a Kiwi, what you do is you do your OE, your overseas experience. You usually go to London, get a flat in Shepherd's Bush, and, you know, drink for a year or two. And
we know those people.
Exactly.
We've seen those people.
Exactly. And, you know, and it's kind of part of the rite of passage. I think for me, when I got to about 25, I didn't want to do that. I'd been working as a lawyer. I had a law degree, worked as a lawyer, hated law, moved into working in production and advertising. It was what my family's in filmmaking. But I was like, I want to get out of here. I want to kind of explore the world. I don't want to go to England. I want to go to Europe. I was in love with kind of the European dream. So I moved to France to teach English under the kind of, the plan was obviously to meet a French woman. And I met a Spanish woman in France. So I was living in Toulouse in southern France for a year. And then 3 months in, I met Yolanda, who's now my wife. She was doing the same thing, not looking for a French man. She was just looking to kind of get out. She'd studied
French.
Or a Kiwi. She would not look going to France looking for a Kiwi. That would be a very roundabout way. But, you know, she was just looking to get out of home and finish her degree in translation interpreting. So we're in France. We started this relationship. We were there for about 8 months together, speaking in French, because she wasn't confident with her English. I didn't speak any Spanish. We spoke terrible French to each other. Her French is better than mine. And then it was like, what do we do now? But what I realized is when you move countries, nobody knows you in the new country. So that gives you kind of carte blanche to reinvent yourself, because there's nobody to disappoint. There's nobody to see at the pub on a weekend. And they're like, oh, did you quit your job? Weren't you doing...
Boquerones have arrived.
Exactly. The Boquerones in Vinagre have arrived. One of my favorite tapas in the world. Very healthy, too.
Yeah, they are healthy, aren't they?
They are.
Well, they're drenched in olive oil. Some people would say that as unhealthy, but it is actually healthy.
It is healthy. Well, it hasn't been fried, so they just take the anchovies, they fillet them, drop them in vinegar for a few hours, which effectively pickles them lightly, and then a little bit of garlic, olive oil, and that's it. And anchovies are pretty sustainable as well, so it's good. So we're here, and I'm working in advertising. I hate advertising. I'm like, well, why don't I just quit? I've got nobody to kind of front up to at the pub and be like, oh, I quit my job. And so I did, and I was like, I'm going to be a travel writer. I'm falling in love with Spain. I'm learning about this place. I want to share it. I want to talk about it. So I started started writing, thinking I'd be published in the New York Times within about, you know, 3 weeks, and it'd be great, and I'd be paying the rent as a travel writer.
Oh,
it'd be
yeah.
amazing, the whole dream. Of course, that didn't happen. I did sort of send off these long articles. I didn't even have this concept that would fill an entire travel section, the articles I was sending off to all kind of travel editors, and just wasn't hearing back. So slowly I was like, it started to pick up a little bit. It was like, I need to make a little money here. So I started thinking I could be a guide. I'm learning all this information. Guiding pays well. And I started connecting with a few people who had guiding companies here. And I found a woman, her name's Lauren, who had just started leading food tours in Madrid. And we teamed up. I designed an evening tapas tour, and that led to the foundation of Devour Tours, which is kind of my day job running that. But I don't guide anymore. I now run the company. And so what happened to kind of build that out is, you know, we really help connect, I guess, people who are coming with places like we're at now, like Casa Tony, because if you walk around here, there's so many places that are tourist traps or are just chains or uninteresting and have no sense of place. So we want to say, well, if you're coming to Madrid, if we sit at this table, I can help you understand Madrid through this food. And that's really the idea. But when I stopped guiding, because I'm running the company, I love guiding. I love talking about this. So I started a YouTube channel to kind of guide, instead of one-to-one, one-to-many. And that's been growing a lot. And that's called Spain Revealed. And the idea there is really the same thing, to share my love and passion for Spain with people who are coming there. Kind of trying to take them beyond the guidebook. I read guidebooks and I'm like, does that person live here? And, you know, guidebooks often seem to have a lot of recommendations in them that are kind of like, yeah, that place isn't good anymore. Or so I kind of want to give something a little bit more updated, a little bit more dynamic. And so that's what I do. I make videos with my wife. We go on tapas crawls together. We do videos at home. We talk about Spanish culture. And it's kind of taken on a life of its own. And that's kind of my life now.
It sounds like a very charmed life, and yeah. something that...
a lot of people dream of doing. Has there been any downsides to it?
I work a lot, particularly balancing two things. I think that's been a challenge of kind of juggling a lot of balls. You know what? There hasn't been that many. Just the normal challenges of growing something and figuring it out and learning. You know, I wish I'd started the YouTube channel earlier, for example. But no, there hasn't been too many downsides. I think one of the challenges I find more and more is that my job is to be in bars. And that can be charmed in some ways, but also you think, oh, you know, if I worked at a bank, I'd just go home at 6 o'clock and not have to kind of then go and, you know, be in a bar somewhere at 9 p.m. So you start thinking, well, what does this look like long term? But more and more also on the channel, I want to talk about things beyond food, because my interest in Spain is not just the food. Food is just a fascinating way to help people understand a place. There's a place next door that's famous for its chili prawns, Gambas al Ajillo. They started making that dish after the Spanish Civil War because there was a bread shortage. They used to make sandwiches, and so they made mine shrimp. So suddenly it's like, if I say to you, hey, let me tell you about Franco, you'd be like, oh my God. But if I say, well, let me tell you about Franco through the history of this dish, suddenly it helps the medicine go down.
You're talking about the person who did their dissertation at university on the history of Spain through festivals and
fiestas. Does that exist?
From General Franco onwards. So I am absolutely fascinated by that, yeah. Particularly at the time under Franco. You know, it's just, Spain is like the biggest place for, the most popular place for UK tourists to visit. Yeah. You know, millions of us come here every year. But we don't understand what we were walking the same streets where very great atrocities happened. Yeah. And even until the 70s, people were not allowed to meet in the street. More than three people meeting in the street was considered a potential uprising. Yeah. You weren't allowed to wear bikinis or skinny clothes. And that's it, you know, in the early 70s when places like Torremolinos and Benidorm were becoming very fashionable and popular and actually in a very sort of upper class way at first. You know, people talk about those places now as being like a sort of down market tourist destination.
They were the beginning of, sand and the whole deal. Absolutely. No, it's true. Speaking to my wife about when her parents got married in the early 70s, I guess it would have been, mid 70s, you know, her mother was not allowed to open a bank account without her husband's, you know, my father-in-law's permission. And, you know, all these kind of rules that obviously don't exist anymore. But I always feel like when you're in Spain, you're touching the past constantly. And you know, I haven't lived years in France, and maybe it's the same, or Germany or the UK. Certainly as a Kiwi boy, you don't feel that the same way in New Zealand. But in Spain, you feel like there's, maybe because the dictatorship lasted until the 70s, there were certain just things that held on, and are still with us today. You know, even the kind of the macho culture and things like that. Having said that, in the last 10 years that I've been in Madrid, or almost 10 years, I've seen a lot of change and a lot of globalization kind of creeping in that was not here 10 years ago. So, you know, even just walking to this bar now to meet, there, 10 years ago, there would have been more traditional places around here, but, you know, opposite, there used to be a ham place, now it's gelato. So more and more, it's like, well, what is that? You know, there's even a laundromat up there. You know what a laundromat means? It means Airbnbs are in here. So more and more, it's like these places, we have to fight for them. Not just us, but also locals. But it's hard when you're a local. As you say, you don't know your own country. Sometimes you don't know what you got till you haven't got it.
You know what? It's really funny you should say that. And I want us to eat, so do some eating.
No, don't worry. I'm going to eat.
It's really funny you should say that, because as a resident of the Costa del Sol and one of those touristy towns we're talking about, I moved to Fuengirola when I was 7 years old in 1981. I've seen some great changes. However, the changes that I've seen in the last 10 years have actually been very positive ones.
Interesting.
10 or 15 years, because in the 80s and 90s, in the 70s as well, it was like Benidorm and Torremolinos, it was subject to a lot of deregulated or unregulated building where apartments shot up everywhere, really ugly, trashed the seafront, became very bucket and spade, very fish and chips, very English breakfast and very down market. In the 80s and 90s, particularly in the 90s when I became aware of this, I got a little bit ashamed of the place. Yeah. I was a bit like, oh, this is a bit embarrassing. It's not
even the word Costa del Sol kind of has a lot of
connotations. In the last 10 to 15 years, and I've written about this for the National Geographic Traveller, it's changed 100% for the better. The people have realised, you know, it's that, you know, the mayoress has been amazing, and you know, the people in the local government have been amazing. They've redone all the seafronts. Mm. They've in Fuengirola town centre. Yeah. They've pedestrianised all the little tiny Spanish roads, and they are now full of tapas bars.
Yeah.
Whereas to get traditional tapas like this, we used to have to go out of town. We used to have to either go to Malaga City or some of the back streets that were sort of further along into Fuengirola. There'd be like one or two in the centre of town. Yeah. Now they're everywhere. But you cannot move. I think, you know, I can think of like 300 in the town centre. From gourmet food and modern Spanish tapas, because modern Spanish food is amazing and got a great reputation, particularly up north, to, you know, the very cheap and cheerful. Yeah. And it's wonderful. It's really, really lovely to see. And even anecdotally amongst my peers, like back in London, which considers itself the coolest place on the planet, whether for better or for worse, people are going, oh, yeah, we're going to Fuengirola. We're going to...
Oh, really?
And it's, you know, I can, even anecdotally, I can see that it's changed, that it's actually okay to go there now.
It's coming back.
Yeah, it's not even, you know, it's back. It's back with a bang. And it's funny that in Madrid you're seeing almost the erosion slightly of some of that sort of Spanish culture.
Yeah, it's true. It's interesting how a country, particularly, you know, a bigger country, it's not one place. You know, Spain is very much not one place, with particularly, you know, the secessionist movement in Catalonia and things like that. It's very much a region of different peoples thrust together.
As I recall, 16 autonomous regions, but that's going back to my
school. Yeah, exactly.
So I haven't thought about that since I was 12.
And they are autonomous regions, you know, more kind of maybe feel more autonomous than others. And it's so interesting how you can think about it. So whereas you think about the north of Spain just starting to get tourists, whereas the south of Spain has had them for decades. And Madrid, I think, what I'm seeing in Madrid is at a local level, locals are falling back in love with their traditions. So a lot of newer tapas bars that are opening are recalling kind of older Madrid tapas bars. You're seeing that kind of trend. But they're still possibly got like some sort of restaurant group behind them. So you have Casatoni, David and Juan, their brothers, you know, and that kind of place is less and less, because in the center the rents are such that you just can't survive. I don't know what that means down the line, but you know, when you create a bar in the image of something, it's inherently less organic, it's inherently a little less interesting. So I'm seeing a lot of that, and I'm seeing it in the food as well. It's interesting, where I live in Delicias, a neighborhood just about 10-minute metro right away, there was a new bar that opened celebrating the whole vermouth tradition, you know, which is very historic in Madrid, but went out of fashion but came back in the last 5 years, became very hipster to drink vermouth. And they have different tapas and things like that, traditional Madrid tapas, but they're kind of soulless a little bit. And then there's a place down the road run by this guy who has the wonderful name of Dionysus, and he's been there for, you know, 30, 40 years, and he's cooking great food on the grill, and the recipes are better. And so I fear that if those places close, we lose some of the recipes as well. The great way of making cazón, which is, you know, marinated in vinegar, shark effectively, or dogfish it's called. I've had it in both places, and it's phenomenal in the old place, and it's just kind of like a bland, you know, cardboard cutout version in the new place. And it's like, what if we lose those recipes, or we lose the skill of doing it well? Then that would be sad.
Yeah, I get what you mean in talking about the places in Fuengirola, you know, the resurgence of things. Some of that resurgence has been those chains, and they're like Irish bars for all the world. They look like, you know, they've been there 100 years, but actually they've brought in the tiles, they're brand new, they're part of the chain, and they sort of hide behind that. So there is definitely that going on. So do you think there has been a problem with, you know, you mentioned Airbnb, and, you know, Barcelona has really had a very serious issue in people turning against tourism. Do you think Madrid has been subject to those sort of issues as well?
Not quite yet. Madrid is Barcelona's historic center, the Born and the Gothic Quarter, particularly the Gothic Quarter, very small area. And so it just feels much more intense, the presence of tourists. You know, the streets are even narrower. Madrid hasn't quite felt it the same way. There is that concern and that pushback against, say, Airbnb and the touristification of the center. But it's not quite at the same level as Barcelona. But it will come if it continues. You know, I mean, the main driver for that, for people's concerns, are rent. You know, rent rises, and even, you know, where I live outside the center, rents have shot up dramatically in the past couple of years, past 3 years. And so, yeah, you kind of throw out the baby with the bathwater. It's like, yeah, okay, someone comes in with their interest in making more money. but then the very thing that people were coming for originally disappears. And so, like, where does that leave us, you know?
The differences between Madrid and Barcelona are intriguing as well, because Barcelona seems to be, and I don't know how this lies in terms of official figures, but it seems to be the more popular place for people to visit. I was speaking to some local friends in London the other day, and one of them Spanish, and he's from Spain, and he's like, oh, I've never been to Madrid.
Yeah.
And actually, this is only my second time to Madrid.
Where is he from in Spain?
Oh, that's a very good point. You said he's from Barcelona, from Catalonia. So, you know, there might be some historic sort of issues with that. But I think, like, everyone, when I meet people in the north of England, they say they've never been to London. I kind of look at them with a bit of a raised eyebrow. It's like, really? Your capital city? You've never even been?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot built into that, particularly if he's Catalan and he may never come to Madrid. Which may have never had reason to, but there may be something for him around what Madrid represents in terms of central government and oppression and things like that. But you do see they are very, very different cities. And, you know, Madrid is growing in popularity. I'm seeing that because people are starting to look for alternatives to Barcelona because of, well, first of all, everyone's been there once, right? And so when I used to give tours and I would meet people here in Madrid, and I'd be like, have you been to Spain before? And they'd be like, yeah, I've been to Barcelona. I'd be like, of course. And they'd never been to Madrid, which I thought was great, because it's like, okay, I got like virgins in front of me. I can really help you understand this place. But it's normal that happens, that there's that one destination. But I think what we're seeing now is, you know, there was an article in the New York Times recently saying, you know, what are the alternatives to famous destinations? And instead of going to Barcelona, go to Valencia. And I'm seeing some of that surge happening for Madrid because people say, well, maybe Madrid's more quote unquote authentic than Barcelona if it's being kind of over, you know, over touristed and those real places kind of don't exist anymore. But, you know, it also depends on the generation of people. My parents-in-law, my mother-in-law recently went to Portugal for the first time, but before that, they'd never left the country. They're in their 60s. And it's very much of that generation as well, of like a time going through a dictatorship where I assume it was a very kind of, you kept to yourself, you kept to your family, it was a kind of an insular time. And that created a certain maybe culture around not too much movement around the country. But yeah, I don't know how it is in England. It's true. Everybody, it's almost like nobody's a Spaniard. Everybody identifies with their pueblo, you know, and that is the true nationality. And their pueblo is always the best pueblo in Spain. And so you do really feel that, even reading books, you know, Laurie Lee, or going back further to George Borrow, people identified with the regions and not necessarily with the country. Now, more we do now, probably since joining the EU, but I think it's still strong, it's still there. It's like, I'm Catalan or I'm Gallego, you know. So almost if people are going to be the most into call themselves Spanish, it's probably Madrid, because you don't have the complex against Madrid because you're from Madrid, potentially. But it is very much a country of villages and kingdoms.
There's so many things I want to ask you. I feel like I could veer into politics right now, into history, into culture, but I'm going to concentrate on you because we like personal stories on this podcast. So what would you say has been your standout Madrid moment? If you were to write your memoirs, what has been like maybe the best night out?
Wow, that's a really hard question. There's a place in, if anyone ever comes to Madrid, I just got a hot pepper, so I need to drink some beer.
Oh, really? Oh, right. You've got the Russian, the pepper roulette. I could do with another beer, actually, if
you
want someone.
Yeah, wave Juan down. As I was sipping that beer, I just turned to my left and saw the building next to me being gutted, no doubt, to become a hotel. So,
what a beautiful building, though, with the shutters.
Well, the fact is, we don't want to lose it either, so...
No, I guess it's just progress, isn't it? It's one of those beautiful, you know, because we're in a very narrow alleyway, and, you know, everyone can sort of visualise those wooden slatted shutters and wrought iron, tiny little Juliet balconies, they're called, aren't they?
Exactly, yeah, it's a beautiful building,
really,
but
beautiful,
it's been empty for a while, so yeah.
So it's probably a good thing.
It's probably a good thing, because it will preserve. I'll wave down Juan for more beer when he looks up.
Yeah.
Standout moment, that's a hard one. There's been a lot of kind of, you know, important moments, I guess, in Madrid. There's a piano bar, which is quite surreal, in the Chueca neighborhood called Tony Dos, or Tony Two. And it's just something that is so Spanish and so out of this world. It only really kicks off at about 11 p.m. And usually you go about 1 a.m. and there's this sort of 4-meter-long piano. And it's surrounded by what we call pijos, which is very wealthy, Spanish, you know, upper class. And they've all got far-fawcett hairdos and look like footballers. And you go and you surround this piano. And everybody's singing these kind of, you know... you know, Yo Soy del Mediterráneo, all these kind of classic Spanish songs. And it's just this kind of wonderful moment of Spanishness, I guess, where everybody kind of just kind of looks like they're from the 70s, and there's something very Madrid about that, that almost Madrid has this timeless quality that, although, you know, we get a bit fashionable and things like that, there's an element to the city which always feels like you could be in any age, no matter what, you know, you turn around, you could be in the 40s looking down the street, or you could be in there, you're in the 70s and it looks like Dallas or something like that. And I think that for me is Madrid, is this kind of village-like quality that it has, although it's a huge capital where people will come together, surround a piano, and chat to each other and sing these kind of Spanish classics. And although there's probably dukes and duchesses around there, and then there's kind of, you know, people who are not dukes and duchesses and are, you know, middle class, whatever, everybody kind of comes together. And I don't know, there's something kind of powerful. It's not even moving. It's just very Spanish. And I don't know any other country that I've been in where people come together quite in the same way in like a bar. And you have all kind of, you know, even here in Casatoni, you'll have, I've been in Casatoni and sat down next to a guy in a tuxedo. You know, we're at wooden tables. This is a real tavern. And then you've got, you know, the plumber over at the next table. And I think these kind of places, what I love about Madrid is it just brings everyone together. And so any night in these places is for me just fantastic. And if you're in New Zealand, you're going to be in like a working man's pub, or you're going to be in a fancy restaurant. Everyone's wearing the right clothes for that place. But these kind of places, people just come together. And that doesn't mean that it's all, you know, perfect and harmonious and things like that. But Spanish bars and this piano bar or Casatoni, there's a great leveler. And there's just so much wonderful energy. And people just talk to each other. So, I don't know. You have to go to Tony Dos. It's a pretty phenomenal place.
Well, we are in Casatoni. So Tony Dos has got nothing
there
to do
with it. There you go. No, completely. Yeah, I don't want to confuse people.
Yeah, because Tony Dos is Tony. Where's Tony 1?
Yeah, exactly. This must be Tony 1.
Yeah.
¿Conoces Tony 2, el bar en Chueca? ¿No te suena? Ah, sí, nunca has estado. Pues tendrías que ir súper tarde. Sí, a partir de las 2. Sí, hay un piano súper largo, hay gente alrededor cantando, canciones, bueno, tradicionales y tal. Es muy pijo. Sí, como tú. Un pelín facha, a lo mejor también. Como tú.
Gracias.
So
I always interpreted when growing up, I always thought pijo was like snob. That's how I saw pijo.
Yeah, no, pijo is like preppy. It's like old money.
Yeah.
They have
certain there's a lot
characters.
Of that in Spain.
There's a lot of that in Spain, yeah. And that, you know, it's like winners write history, right? It's like there's a great documentary about the Civil War. I think it's Granada TV. British Granada, not Spanish Granada. And it's about the Civil War, and it's, you know, people who are still alive from having fought or lived through the Civil War, and you can see who won the Civil War. It's like all these lawyers sitting in nice offices are on the winning side, and everybody who lost, they're sitting in their living room and tatty couches and sofas and telling their side of the story, and that legacy still hangs on. So there's kind of, you know, I don't know what it's like in England, but there's a very entrenched kind of upper class that follows certain modalities, what you wear, where you go to Tony Dos, you're still joined by this common kind of cultural element. You still know the same songs, but you live a very different life.
Oh yeah, that is still absolutely ongoing in the UK, isn't it? It really is, absolutely. And, you know, talking a second about the legacy of the Civil War, I mean, God, I could go on about this for ages, but you drive around Andalusia where people literally starve to death.
Yeah.
You know, people literally starve to death in Andalusia.
Yeah.
And you drive around the inner hills. You only have to go like 10 minutes off the coast up to even Mijas, you know, a very touristy village now, and you can see the remnants of people's houses that they just left, the old fincas, the old, you know, hand-built buildings, you know, farmhouses and tiny mountain houses that they just had to leave and never came back.
And
they're still exhuming bodies and things now, aren't
they?
You know?
Yeah.
Have you been to where Franco is buried?
The Valley of the Fallen.
I've never been, and I wonder whether I'd like to go, but I probably would like to go.
I think you should go. I think you have that curiosity. I've been a couple times from writing an article and things like that, and I just think it's something that, again, last time I was there, it's kind of, when people come to visit who are interested in history, that's on my to-do list. You know, it's like, you've got to see this place. It's surreal that it still exists, that he's still buried there in effectively a church. There's mass every day. And what's surreal is when you go to the Valley of the Fallen, it's like something out of Tolkien. You're walking into this basilica that's carved out of the granite and the rock, and you walk into this place, and there's like huge statues of archangels with swords at the ready and hooded monks looking down as you walk through. And then you arrive to this kind of crucifix and it's this, it's Christ on the cross, but it's not even a normal cross. It's this gnarled kind of wood, sort of like a long kind of two literal branches that are very gnarled. So it's, I mean, it's like you couldn't cut, Catholicism is great at drama, right? You couldn't cut, the lighting is perfect, you know. It's like when you walk into churches sometimes and it's dark and then suddenly like the automatic light goes on and it's like perfectly there on Christ with the blood and things like that. It's like they got it nailed. And so you go to the
nailed is a terrible word.
Exactly.
It literally nailed.
And so you walk into the Valley of the Fallen and you're like, how? And there's Franco buried behind the cross, flowers on his grave. And when I took my family up to show them this place, because I thought they'd be very curious about it, there was a guy who walked in with flowers, did the kind of fascist salute as he walked in over Franco's grave and put flowers down. And that happens there every day.
And because it's civil war, like in the UK, you know, we've had our fair share of wars, but they haven't been on our land, or not for many, many years.
Yeah.
And because it's civil war, there's people living, there's old people right now living side by side,
yeah,
you know, that fought against each other and hated each other, and yeah, they've just got to get, and they've got on with it for, yeah, so many years. Anyway, I could go on about this forever. I think that, well, we've got food to finish, we've got beers to drink, and just to sum it up, what do you think are your top three food experiences in Madrid?
If anyone, good question. I mean, here. I want to give Casa Tony a lot of business. I don't want to overload them too much, but I think this is one of the places that I love because it's yummy, it's simple, it's cheap, it's in the center. There's not many local places here still, so Casa Tony would be one of them. I think going to a market, going to a traditional market, people sometimes think the Mercado San Miguel is a traditional market. It's not. It's a gourmet tapas hall, so I would go to a market like Mercado de la Paz or the Anton Martin market. These are places where you can go and you can buy, particularly if you want to eat great ham and great cheese and buy great wine. If you order those in a tapas bar, you're going to pay a huge premium on them. And all they're going to do is carve it, the same as the guy in the market. So going to a market and ordering those things and having a picnic is one of the best ways to more cost-effectively try these incredible products that don't need to be prepared or cooked.
Where would you have that picnic? The second thing, isn't it? I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you.
Number two can be market and picnic.
Market and picnic.
And so I would have the picnic in the Retiro Park. And if it's winter, I don't know, do it in your hotel room. But just a great place to try these delicious things. Number three, wow, that's a good one. What would I say is a great food experience? I think just the experience of going out for tapas and doing it, quote unquote, the right way. And there's not many wrong ways, but I think the right way is understanding that tapas is not a plate of food. If you think it's a plate of food, and it kind of is, like, you know, we have tapas in front of us, you're looking at it in a too limited way. You have to think of tapas as we in Spain think about it as a verb, tapear. It's an action, and it's kind of a way of going out. So yeah, you're going to eat food, you're going to be sharing plates with people, you're going to be reaching across people, you're going to be standing at the bar, you're going to be striking up a conversation with the person next to you, you're going to be going somewhere else maybe after a few beers. So I think understanding that tapear is what tapas is, the verb, it's the sharing, it's the energy, it's the dynamism of it. And you know, the food can be anything, but it's the activity which kind of intends it. So try and kind of grasp that. I try and give a sense of that in my videos so people can kind of see it, because it's hard to get it until you see it or do it. So try and do it, you know, talk to people, even if you don't speak much Spanish, like maybe they'll speak a bit of English, but try and get that, you know, have a couple of beers to get Dutch courage, but that's part of it.
That's wonderful. So I'm going to ask you my last question. My last question is always about music, because yeah, I believe that for many people, for me certainly, music and travel go hand in hand.
Yeah.
If you had to think of one song that reminds you of a memorable time or place of travel, what would that one song be, and where were you?
It would have to be flamenco, that genre, which is from the south of Spain. It's from the Cádiz area originally, but it has a very murky history. We're not quite sure. I mean, flamenco means someone from someone who's Flemish, and so why is that the name of the word? You know, we don't know, but my wife is very into it. I love flamenco, so it would be flamenco. And there's an album that came out a couple years ago. It was nominated for a Grammy by a flamenco singer called Antonio Reyes, and it's a live album, and there's one song, and it doesn't really have a name as such that I remember, because flamenco songs is traditional lyrics, but the palo, the type of song, is an alegría, which is the kind of the happier, the beautiful.
I used to dance those.
They're so wonderful. And it's a song that just talks about, you know, in the way that flamenco does, talks about very simple things. Like I was walking down the road one day and it got dark and I got lost and I was trying to go by the light of my cigarette, but I lost my way and I couldn't find the mill. You know, very simple stuff. But when I think of that, it just reminds me of being in southern Spain, in Cádiz, which is for me one of the most magical parts of Spain. And Cádiz is a region, it's also a city. As a city, for me, it is the most fascinating city in the entire country. It's this little spit of land out into the Atlantic, been inhabited, but thousands of years, Phoenicians, Romans, Greeks have all been there and just built up on layers. And it feels like a poor man's Seville in a lot of ways. And even the stonework and the buildings have like shells in them, oyster shells, because they've been pulled up from the sea. And you can feel the decadence of kind of like the time when that was where all the wealth was coming from the Americas, but then it went into decay. And I think flamenco's kind of come out of that period of this time of kind of poverty and yet joy in the simple things. And I think that makes me think of being in Cádiz with my wife, sipping sherry and walking through those narrow streets.
Oh, and I've been there and I've done it and I've sipped that sherry and walked through those narrow streets and I absolutely love it. I'm a total Spanophile, as are you. We've got beer to finish and drinks to have. And I also want to have coffee. Mm. And you and I spoke on the phone about the coffee because I think that Spanish coffee is one of the best in the world. And you've done a YouTube video recently saying that you think it's rubbish. So we're on, I don't know. I have Spanish coffee in Andalusia and it's amazing. I'm going to have a Madrid coffee and see who's right about
this. You're going to have to see it. You're going to see who's right. I mean, coffee is, taste is memory and emotion is built into taste. So everybody has those different, you know, associations. But yeah, there's, people can check it out in the YouTube video. There's a certain process applied to Spanish coffee, which can make it very dark and bitter. But I've had people come up to me and say the same thing. It's like, I love it. I love it. You know, it was amazing. I sometimes wonder if it's the same reason that people say to me, I can never get hangovers when I'm in Spain, you know, because the wine has less. Exactly. We're like, oh, there's less sulfites in the wine. It's like, no, you were just on holiday and you're having a great time.
Exactly.
So I think that's it. But coffee, I mean, they don't actually serve coffee in Casatoni.
Oh, we'll have to go somewhere else.
Exactly. You have to go somewhere else. But I have got a recommendation where you can get a very local coffee that for me would blow my head off, but you're going to love it.
What is it?
It's a place called La Mallorquina. So it's a place right on the Puerta del Sol. It's like the best pastry shop for me, traditional pastry shop in the city. It's always rammed with grandmothers pushing you out of the way. But they have a bar. You can stand there. You can eat something sweet. The Napolitana de Crema. It's like a pan au chocolat, but with like pastry cream inside, is the classic. And you can get a good dark torrefacto cup of coffee, maybe with milk or not, you know. And the screech of the coffee machine is going the whole time. There's rubbish on the floor. The whole thing. The full deal.
Well, that's wonderful. That's been so enjoyable. Thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me, Lisa.
Thank you so much, James, for a really enjoyable lunch and conversation about one of my favourite countries. We have more On Location episodes coming up, Tuscany and New York to start with. It's been a very busy few weeks. Thank you so much for listening.